The Sunstone Foundation presents Nephi, Seer of Modern Times, the home literature and novels of Nephi Anderson, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
We're glad to welcome you to this session of the Sunstone Symposium. I have an announcement here that this session is being recorded and that tapes will be available shortly following the session at the cassette sales booth. They also ask us to make unnecessary noises, rattling papers, drumming fingers, etc., etc. We're glad to have you here today. I almost didn't accept the assignment for chairing this, because when the people from Sunstone called me and asked me if I would do it, and I said, sure, I'll do it. What's the topic? And they said, Nephi, Seer of Modern Times. And I said, I'm really not into the Book of Mormon. And they said, well, it's not the Book of Mormon. And then they told me what it was about. And I remembered, of course, that Nephi Anderson was an important prophet in the mission field. I came across, just in my father's old library, two books that he had received from missionaries, one from Reed Ellsworth of Safford, Arizona, and William Firmage, the story of Chester Lawrence and Added Upon. Now, I don't have my father's Book of Mormon. I heard him speak more about Nephi Anderson than I did about the Book of Mormon, I'm afraid. We're happy to have our principal speaker today, Richard Craycroft, Professor of English, Dean of the College of Humanities, Brigham Young University, who will speak to the subject, Nephi, Seer of Modern Times, Home Literature, and the Novels of Nephi Anderson.
You ought to hear him read Scottish poetry if you want a real treat. After listening to and reading some of the wonderfully controversial topics of this symposium, I'm confident that my paper on Nephi Anderson will rank somewhere on your palpitating excitement scale between excitement of Sister Harrison's hearing aid going askew in work meeting last month and the bishop's discovery that one of his ward clerk's wife served cherry coke with caffeine to the den group the other week. There are no surprises in my paper. Nephi Anderson would have thought AIDS was a gentle laxative. And yes, he had two wives, but one unfortunately died several years before he met and married the other one. And the most titillating of his books would probably be ranked to rated PG-13 only because a missionary, Elder Dean, has the audacity to fall in love with an English girl while he's on his mission. He repents. But if you're into that kind of bold stuff, then hang on with me, and because I'm going to give you a thrill of emotion which you haven't experienced since your visiting teacher, Sister Davis, had her water break while you were out visiting. At least you'll leave my lecture with tatters of your testimonies tautly intact. In the spirit of dainty tablecloth and tasteful rose, I have tastefully prepared a lovely visual aid which lists the 10 novels of Nephi Anderson so that you can follow roughly. Nephi Anderson, incidentally, the title is a little misprinted in my hand. It is the Nephi Seer of Modern Times, the home literature novels of Nephi Anderson. Nephi Anderson, known primarily among late 20th century Latter-day Saints as the author of Added Upon, an ambitious failure, attempted in that widely read novel, as B.H. Roberts once wrote, to encompass all things in heaven and earth within 140 pages. While Roberts uttered this statement in admiration, I assume Anderson knew better. At least if he didn't then, he would later when he came to be a much more accomplished writer. Endowed as he was with a fine narrative gift, a rich imagination, and a keen sense of appreciation for literary style, Anderson subsequently attempted two major revisions of Added Upon. In a futile effort to transform his wooden tour de force into a lively novel on par with his 9 later novels. Inevitably and sadly, Anderson has been dismissed or heralded on the basis of this first novel, when in fact he would be better served by a study of his 9 later and always better novels. Unfortunately, the 9 later works are now generally unavailable and thus virtually ignored, While Anderson, if he's discussed at all by modern Mormon critics, is dismissed as a one-novel, one-failure author. The truth is otherwise. It's an examination of Anderson's 10 novels, 4 additional books, 40 various articles, and at least 48 identified short stories makes impressively evident he was a vital and positive force in turn-of-the-century Mormon letters. His unparalleled contribution was to combine a remarkably fervent faith in the gospel of Jesus Christ and in the teachings, history, culture, and mission of the Mormon Church with a single-minded devotion to establishing a Mormon literature which reflects this faith. The fact of his popular success among the Latter-day Saints is recorded in the number of editions that his many works enjoyed and which added upon, still in print, still enjoys. But while Mormon critics have generally dismissed Anderson's works without examining more than his first and weakest effort, Anderson's remaining body of writing is of interest to Mormons in the mid-1980s, not only because they reflect fin de siècle LDS and American values and concerns, and not only because Anderson has made the most important sustained literary effort to date in attempting to fashion a significant didactic literature from the stuff of Mormon belief and practice, but also because many of the literary questions he confronted continue to challenge Mormon writers, critics, and readers. His name was Christian Nephi Anderson, and Christian Nephi Anderson was himself a thoroughgoing product of the Mormonism he so fervently professed. Born on January 22, 1865, in Christiania, Norway, to Latter-day Saint parents Christian and Petronelle Nielsen Anderson, Nephi, as he always signed himself, or Nephi, as they pronounce it on the bus, immigrated to the United States with his parents in 1871 when he was only 6 years old. The family settled in Colville and later Ogden, where Nephi's father worked as a painter and paper hanger, a trade which Nephi also learned but soon left for a career in education. Married at 16 to Asenath Tillotson, Nephi received his education in Ogden schools and at the University of Utah. In 1893, he interrupted a career in Box Elder and Weber counties to serve an LDS mission to his native Norway. After his return from Norway, Anderson taught in several schools in Ogden and Brigham City and was named superintendent of schools in Box Elder County, where he served from 1900 to 1903. Soon after the untimely death of his first wife in January 1904, Anderson was called on a second mission, this time to Great Britain, where his renown as a writer on LDS subjects led to service under Mission President Heber J. Grant as editor of the Millennial Star. Following his release in 1906, Anderson made an extensive tour of Europe, after which he returned home to Salt Lake City, where for 3 years he taught as an instructor of English and missionary course teacher at LDS High. In June 1908, Anderson married Maud Rebecca Simons, and in July 1909 was again called, along with his family, to serve as a missionary in the Central States Mission. Headquartered in Independence, Missouri, Anderson edited the Liahona, the voice of the church to the central United States, until the fall of 1910, when he was recalled in order to serve as editor of the Utah Genealogy and Historical Magazine, replacing Elder Joseph Fielding Smith, who had just been called to the Quorum of the Twelve. Anderson served in this post until his untimely death on January 6, 1923, at age 58, from peritonitis, which developed following emergency surgery. Besides being a missionary and a prolific writer, Anderson was a dedicated church leader. In 1910, he was called to the general board of the MIA, where he remained until his death. He also served on the general priesthood committee of the church and prepared several courses of study for the church priesthood quorums. He spent much of his time during his last years traveling among the LDS stakes, giving instruction in genealogy, for which he became a major force in the church. And at his funeral in the 10th Ward, a host of LDS general authorities joined in praising what they called Anderson's genius and skill in teaching and in writing for the Latter-day Saints. It is in his genius and skill as an author in the home literature tradition that modern scholars are most interested. Anderson stands at the head of the home literature movement in Mormon letters, a movement which also included such influential figures as Susa Young Gates, Orson F. Whitney, Emmeline B. Wells, B.H. Roberts, Josephine Spencer, and Augusta Joyce Crocheron. Home literature, fiction, drama, poetry, and essays written by faithful Mormons to instruct other Latter-day Saints in Mormon truth, Mormon faith, Mormon standards, and Mormon commitment, rose to importance over the space of a single decade, 1888 to 1898, the year of added upon. and has continued to be a force in Mormon letters ever since. From the earliest days of the territory of Deseret, the leaders of the Latter-day Saints had little use for fiction, particularly of the dime novel variety then flooding the country. Indeed, George Q. Cannon blamed novel reading for, quote, many of the evils which prevail in the world, quote. It was only after the monolithic strength of Mormon isolation began to be threatened by the influx of Gentiles and their accompanying Gentile values that church leaders, notably Orson F. Whitney, Susie Young Gates, and Emmeline B. Wells, suggested that the church fight the fires of a pervasive popular fiction with a fiction and a literature lit at the torches of LDS values. In 1888, Bishop Whitney, in a major address directed to the youth of the church, called on Mormon writers to produce a literature for home consumption, a home literature, quote, pure and powerful, centered in Mormon themes and reflecting Mormon ideals, a literature which would one day enable the Mormon culture to produce, quote, Miltons and Shakespeares of its own. Responding to this challenge, Anderson wrote and published to wide, though not uncritical, Mormon acclaim, Added Upon, in 1898, a novel based on an idea which he'd begun to formulate in 1893 following his return from his mission to Norway. Excited about the possibilities of a Mormon literature and by the success of this first book, Anderson exclaimed in an essay, A Plea for Fiction, published in the first volume of the Improvement Era, quote, what a field is here in Mormonism for the pen of the novelist, and called for promotion in the stakes of Zion of, quote, the good, the pure, and the elevating in literature. In Added Upon, and in the nine novels which would periodically follow, Anderson attempted to achieve just that. He worked with imaginative vigor to express his appreciation for the impact of the doctrines of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on his life and the lives of all who had been like him caught in the gospel net. Anderson's literary theory is therefore similarly single-minded and focused. In his short story at St. Peter's Gate, published in the Improvement Era in 1917, Anderson tells of a painter, a singer, a writer of books, a physician, a businessman, and a merchant, all applying for entrance to heaven. Each of them, however, had catered in his life only to the wealthy, none of whom was present, unfortunately, to testify in the petitioner's behalf. The author, when asked if he had taught his readers great ideals while on earth, replies, I never had patience with purpose stories. Consequently, the writer, Anderson leads us to believe, went straight to the celestial kingdom with the rest of the gifted but selfish artisans and businessmen. Quote, by all means let us have in literature art for art's sake, he wrote in 1898. Only let us understand what art is. And art for him meant purpose. For art, quote, deals with love and God is love. Art deals with truth and God is the source of all truth. In his essay, Purpose in Fiction, Anderson succinctly states his literary belief in the central tenet of LDS home literature when he insists that, quote, a good story is artistic preaching, and that, quote, a novel which depicts high ideals and gives to us representations of men and women as they should and can be exerts an influence for good that is not easily computed. He concludes that the main object of life is not to be amused, but he who reaches the people, and the story writer does that, quote, should not lose the opportunity of preaching. The process of change and self-realization through the gospel lies at the center of each of Anderson's 10 novels and many short stories. Since missionary work is the vehicle for preaching Mormonism and effecting dramatic changes and insights, Anderson wrote about it more or less in all of his novels and stories. Quote, teaching the gospel to receptive minds is the keenest joy of missionary life, he writes in A Daughter of the North. And in Romance of a Missionary, he writes in a typical passage, the missionary spirit burned within him and drove out all fear. If the door was slammed in his face, he simply hummed softly a song and went on to the next door. After a time, he declared he would rather hold a good street meeting than eat one of Sister McDonald's splendid meals. There was something exhilarating to the soul to have a large company of people stand and listen to the message he was sent to deliver. Anderson's missionary, sometimes weak and often vulnerable, might grow mighty in the work long before the long-sleeved envelope of official release sends them back to their patiently waiting Utah sweethearts. But his missionaries are, after all, only catalysts for broken and contrite hearts. Thus, Anderson portrays again and again the pattern of truth-seeking, acceptance, trial, change, and gratitude. Harold's father and the castle builder speaks for many of Anderson's characters when he says, thank God, the truth has come at last. Such change is the dynamic of Anderson's plots and follows hard on the inevitable temptation and trial, whether after the irate parent has disinherited the young convert, or after the bewildered and handsome Gentile lover has severed his relationship with the newly baptized young woman. The character must then undergo the agony of doubt and the consequences of his new Mormonness. But the hero or heroine inevitably triumphs over self, never to waver again. They change their life, shed Babylon, and embrace the supposed loneliness of Mormonism, only to be surprised by grace and the blessings which follow conversion, often in the form of material and romantic recompense. Despite this purposeful didactic heresy, Anderson developed into a craftsman whose integration of the gospel message into his stories was increasingly subtle and skillful. Though dated, his novels are still generally readable, occasionally charming, often moving, and always faith-promoting. They are not as good as we would hope, but they are much better than some critics have led us to expect, reminding the reader on occasion of the works of such contemporary novelists as William Dean Howells, Edward Eggleston, and Winston Churchill. But the difference between Anderson and other turn-of-the-century writers remains profound. His novels are permeated with Mormonism, which he explores in unprecedented ways. He became the first Latter-day Saint to attempt a literary fusion of life, modern fictional modes, and Mormonism, a fusion which continues to challenge Mormon writers. As Anderson's 10 novels attest, he grew increasingly adept at making that difficult fusion. Nephi Anderson's first attempt, and here we go to this list, at integrating Mormonism and realistic literature is a failure. A failure which has moved several generations of Mormon teenagers, myself included. In Added Upon, 1898, Anderson attempts to follow Signe and Rupert and their friends through premortal life and earth life into the spirit world, through the millennium, and finally into exaltation, with which he chose to deal in blank verse, probably wisely. The best sections of the novel are those concerning earth life, wherein Anderson prefigures his real strength, which is to tell a good story. Even in these premortal sections of Added Upon, however, Anderson fails to pay attention to transitions, to necessary detail, or to logical character development. His protagonist, Rupert, moves from Norway to the American Midwest and West through material success and failure and loss of his true love, only to find at the point of suicide happiness in the restored gospel of Jesus Christ as taught to him by Signe, whom he marries and with whom he moves west once more, only to die in a construction accident. The story then continues to follow the couple, Signe laboring in mortality and Rupert in the spirit world, until they're reunited, resurrected, and eventually glorified. Anderson's avowed purpose, of course, is to demonstrate Mormon teachings and some individual views concerning relationships between the living and the dead, the unborn and the living, and the importance of vicarious ordinances in behalf of the dead. Concerns similarly underlined in such modern spin-offs have Added Upon as Saturday's Warrior, Star Child, and My Turn on Earth. Often impatient and awkward with fiction as a vehicle at this early stage in his career, Anderson frequently stumbles in his attempts to combine story and sermon. It is to his credit, however, that his section on the millennium shows imagination and insight, and perhaps some indebtedness to Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward and William Dean Howells' A Traveler from Altruria. Anderson depicts, for example, a visit to the celestial city by the King of Poland, who is conducted on a tour and taught the Lord's laws of social equality, economics, government, and, of course, theology. It's truly a blessing to live in the holy city, the king learns, when George Washington, Martin Luther, and Socrates arrive together to speak to the children about history. The trio have been, the guide points out, at the School of the Prophets all morning, and now they've just come from the high school yonder. You see what advantages today's students of history have, he adds. Doubtless. Be able to see if those wooden teeth really work. Evidence of artistic growth is abundant, however, in his second novel, Marcus King Mormon, of 1900. More tightly focused, with fewer characters and a smaller canvas, this novel follows Marcus King, a young minister, through his conversion to Mormonism, his rejection by Alice Merton, his betrothed, because of his conversion, and his exodus to Utah, where he meets and eventually marries Janet Harmon. But not until he converts Alice to the gospel, nurses her until her death, and returns to Utah and Janet and temple marriage to both of his loves, living and dead. It's a convenient Deus ex Mormonia ending, which appears in several of Anderson's novels and short stories. Marcus King Mormon is occasionally clumsy in his execution, notably in King's lame and unnecessary confession at the end that he is the author, but has written in third person because of modesty, a point of view which then forces him to explain that passages written in praise of his character have been sneaked in by his wife Janet without his prior knowledge. Still in Marcus King Mormon, far superior and far more readable than added upon, Anderson makes an interesting attempt to examine personal sacrifice on an individual and a collective level. In The Castle Builder of 1902, Anderson's experimentation with technique continues, and with even greater success as he turns to Norway for his setting and relates the fortunes of Harold, a kind of Norwegian Horatio Alger who rises from rags to Mormonism, and his lovely Thora, a wealthy lass who eventually renounces all for Mormonism and Harold. Anderson's developing technique is seen in his obvious but sustained use of unifying symbolism in a number of rose and castle-building images, for example, as well as in his soaring romantic descriptions of Norwegian landscapes, which he attempts, often successfully, to parallel with beautiful gospel inscapes. The Castle Builder, though sometimes overwritten, becomes Anderson's first real novel, and he manages to mute gospel preaching and underscore the realities of human psychology as his hero and heroine make important accommodations in their lives because of their new faith. In his fourth novel, Piney Ridge Cottage of 1912, published a decade after The Castle Builder, Anderson sets the story in Utah and attempts to deal directly with the importance of marrying within the faith. Julia Elston, a cultivated and beautiful Mormon girl who reads The Atlantic, Harper's, and Ladies' Home Journal, along with the church magazines, of course, has her certain future with Glenn Curtis temporarily disrupted when her handsome half-brother, a confirmed and tenacious Gentile, arrives from Chicago, falls in love with her, and is softened by his association with the Latter-day Saints and is taught the gospel. The question throughout, however, is whether the Gentile, named Chester Lawrence, is converted to Julia or to Mormonism. Julia opts, after great internal turmoil, to marry Glenn Curtis, who is promptly called on a mission. He goes, of course, as, quote, refusal of a mission call, Anderson teaches, quote, never enters the mind of a true Latter-day Saint. Chester, spurned, eventually leaves as well, heartbroken but true to his newfound faith. All ends well when Julia receives a belated but comforting spiritual witness that she has done the right thing. In Piney Ridge Cottage, Anderson portrays human psychology by dealing with inner turmoil. He demonstrates clearly and with a sophistication uncommon in home literature that even when one lives a righteous life, decisions are not always easy. It is only after Julia's struggle and decision that she receives her spiritual confirmation. In this novel, Anderson manages to also to use a passable dialect and to portray a missionary farewell party with such effective local color that the reader is reminded of Bret Hart and even Sarah Orne Jewett. The gospel, while integral to the book's fabric, is often made subsidiary or tangential to the drama being enacted in the misunderstandings and decisions of the major characters. Piney Ridge Cottage has a weak sequel in The Story of Chester Lawrence, 1913, in which Anderson takes the story of Gentile Coombe Saint Chester Lawrence to a fanciful but not very satisfying conclusion. Trying to heal his wounds, Chester, while traveling by ship to England, meets and falls in love with the lovely but frail Lucy Strong. Chester converts Lucy to Mormonism, much to the discomfort of her adopted minister father, who turns out to be the illegitimate father of Chester Lawrence. After some weeks in England, Lucy, terminally ill, is hastened homeward on an unseaworthy ship, which sinks. While the ship is sinking, and Anderson is taking all utmost advantage of the Lusitania anguish, Lucy dies of several natural causes. Chester nobly gives the last place in the last boat to the Reverend Mr. Strong, her father, who goes sorrowing to Utah, where he joins the church and has the temple ceilings performed in behalf of Chester and Lucy. The story of Chester Lawrence, not nearly as successful as either The Castle Builder or Piney Ridge Cottage, is literally one step backward taken, flawed as it is in its very conception. But there are some successful moments as well, scenes which demonstrate that Anderson was still growing in his technique. He handles, for example, the various settings of Ireland, England, Paris, and Lucerne in vivid prose, and also gives his readers their first taste of Mormon proselytizing, as Chester, during his London stay, accompanies the missionaries in their endeavors. Throughout the book, Anderson also crafts an internal unity through using Lucy as a leitmotif. He also suggests very subtly the symbolic relationships between Chester's voyaging and his life. One of the greatest evidences of Anderson's development as a writer comes, however, in his next novel, A Daughter of the North of 1915, clearly one of his best. A kind of reversal of the castle builder, A Daughter of the North examines the effects on Otelia Heldman, a lovely, wealthy, talented, nationally renowned Norwegian boat racer, of her conversion to Mormonism. Otelia, finding she can't embrace both Mormonism and her beloved Halvor Steen, is tempted to recant. But she remains firm and passes the conversion agony to Halvor, who eventually joins the church after proving to himself that his conversion is genuine. The couple rejoice in their newfound church and emigrate to Utah, where they're sealed in the Salt Lake Temple. You notice each of the endings is the same. A Daughter of the North, full of internal character, turmoil, lovely settings, and believable conversation and plot, is an exciting novel. It's packed with several adventures, including fire and shipwreck, all set against the backdrop of Norway's spectacular fjords and painted on a Mormon canvas, not merely sprayed with a Mormon veneer. Anderson's characters are real, as is their misery, their joy, their love, and their impatience in waiting for the happiness they eventually achieve. A Daughter of the North still reads well, and might be favorably compared with such second-rank American novels as Harold Frederick's The Damnation of Theron Ware or Edward Eggleston's The Hoosier Schoolmaster. With John St. John in 1917, however, Anderson suffers a relapse, a failure of focus in art, selling his simmering pot of fiction for an epistolary mess of Mormon history. Like Marcus King, John St. John leaves a life of ease and wealth to investigate Mormonism's claims. He joins the saints in Missouri, is converted, and in a long series of letters to his believing mother and his inane and lifeless fiancée, Dora, John relates the high points of LDS church history through the Missourian Nauvoo period. Dull Dora and her lovely sister Jane visit John and his mother in Nauvoo, but Dora continues to resist the faith, while Jane becomes converted to Mormonism and to John. This fragmented retelling of early church history is followed by a rushed postscript in which Anderson boggles the reader's mind by revealing that John St. John, now in middle age, is prosperous and the husband of both Dora, the dull and unbending Gentile, and the vivacious, charming, and believable Jane, a truly Mormon ending. John St. John, while it depicts some notable scenes, incidentally their sons are named Hiram and Joseph, is an artistic failure in which Anderson attempted to create in fiction that which he had already better accomplished in exposition in his A Young Folk's History of the Church of 1898. In his next novel, The Romance of a Missionary, 1919, Anderson successfully follows Elder Willard Dean through first faltering steps as a missionary into a brief flirtation with English saint Elsa Fernley, who reciprocates, causing him to flee the city and to come of age as an effective and mature missionary confronted by the problems of working among the lower classes in industrial England. Toward the end of his mission, Elder Dean assists in sending Elsa to Utah, where she marries Willard's best friend. At the end of the book, Willard, still on his mission, is assured in a well-crafted prophetic daydream of a bright future with Grace Wells, his lovely Utah love. In The Romance of a Missionary, Anderson skillfully treats the English rural and urban contrasts and portrays several of his characters with a richness previously found only in A Daughter of the North. His missionaries have frailties as well as strengths, and among his Englishmen are authentic portraits of poor and distressed human beings as well as believable portraits of the middle class. Anderson weaves into his story a subplot involving a young woman cousin whose life has been blighted by her lover's alcoholism. Elder Dean is able to effect reform and conversion in the young man and eventual reconciliation with his fiancée. But Anderson is full of surprises. His ninth novel is totally different from his earlier works. The Boys of Springtown, 1920, is a pleasant summertime idyll about William Wallace Jones, a young convert to the church from England, sent to live with his aunt in Springtown, Utah, while his mother saves enough money to transport herself to the American West. Anderson unfolds in a sprightly and entertaining style reminiscent of the works of the Jorgensen brothers, a number of adventures among the lively Mormon boys of Springtown. The book, lighthearted and charming, its Mormonness remarkably subtle, still reads well and continues to be read and appreciated where it's available as a kind of Mormon Tom Sawyer or Penrod. Dorian, 1921, probably his best and certainly his boldest novel. Dorian is the story of Dorian Treat, a small-town Mormon boy with intellectual abilities which have been fanned to white heat by Uncle Zed, the town philosopher and avid disciple of Orson Pratt. Dorian, a reader of Dickens, Thackeray, Huxley, Ingersoll, and Thomas Paine, is deepened by the death of his first love, Mildred Brown, which turns him more fervently to philosophy and away from the practicality and awareness of the unwavering love of his lovely neighbor, Carlia Duke. Dorian is first shaken into realization of his own feelings for Carlia by the attentions paid her by Jack Lamont, a traveling salesman with an automobile and dubious background. When they go together. When Carlia disappears for several months, Dorian undertakes a search for her, only to learn that months earlier, Jack, the salesman, had drugged and seduced Carlia, who had given birth to an illegitimate child, born dead. Dorian discovers the truth, and that Carlia, ashamed and fearful, remains in hiding. He eventually finds her and attempts to answer to himself the question, could he let his love for her overcome the repulsion which would arise like a black cloud into his thoughts? Gradually, he finds he can love her without qualification. Without revealing to her that he knows of her baby, he takes her home, where she eventually confesses her fall, only to find that Dorian has known all along, having learned the lesson of the book, which is, one must not only learn, but also live the tenets of the theology one studies. As the book ends, a year later, Carlia has about completed what Anderson calls a period of purification. And after discussing their future plans for education and temple marriage, the sadder but wiser pair walk on hand in hand, writes Anderson symbolically, quote, down into the valley of sunshine and shadow. Dorian is Anderson's mature novel, and it's generally a success. Artistically, Anderson has come a long way. Gospel discussions among the characters continue to be important to the book, as in all of Anderson's works. But in Dorian, they often form a counterpoint with the ongoing life of the valley and are sometimes obstacles to Dorian's real understanding of Carlia and of life. The novel is real. In the foreground are several human dilemmas and problems, and Carlia's fall and Dorian's ability to forgive and his willingness eventually to marry her in the temple suggest a maturity and wisdom in Anderson's final novel, which makes it the success it generally is. Dorian recalls Thomas Hardy's Tessa the D'Urbervilles. But unlike Angel Clare, Dorian demonstrates his own Christian willingness to forgive. Carlia is real. She pouts, frets, grows angry, despairs. Dorian becomes angry, fights, swears, and irritates the reader in his short-sightedness regarding her plight. All of this tempers Dorian's superior intellectual powers and gentles him to believability. His triumph comes in his struggle to harmonize his knowledge of science and Mormonism with his forgiving relationship with Carlia. Dorian also underscores maturity not only in Anderson but in his readers, or at least in Anderson's respect for his readers, and fosters hope for a more sophisticated LDS home literature. With Anderson's untimely passing, however, such promise was left unrealized. For in the next half century, home literature, conforming to the enervating policies of the church magazines, would fall far short of the promise to which Anderson had pointed at the end of his career. Carl Keller proclaims that literature cannot be theological tracts with dogma abstracted, ideas preached and harped on, and insists that literature is seldom written and can seldom be written in the service of religion. Nephi Anderson, unwilling and unable as he was to separate creed from experience or art from belief, would strongly disagree. Still, while his work falls short of modern critical expectations, Anderson moves steadily from writing the dogmatic didacticism which Keller attacks toward more subtle portrayals of life as experienced by a man whose meat and drink and air were Mormon. His accomplishments should be instructive to modern Mormon writers, for like many present writers, he was fascinated by the flood subjects of missionary and conversion experiences and by the old verities of repentance, personal worth, love, pride, humility, and spirituality. And he attempted to deal with such themes in a way which is at once artistic and orthodox, a challenge which many current Latter-day Saints, captivated by Babylon, discuss, but few attempt and fewer succeed in meeting. Unable to separate Mormonism out from the fibers of his art, Nephi Anderson tried very hard to turn his positive Mormon experience into significant art. In Anderson's successes and failures, in his steady progress from artless dogma to gently dogmatic art, are lessons to be learned by modern Mormon readers, critics, and a whole new generation of writers. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. The commentary will be given by Karen Lynn, University of California.
I have a friend whose father's name by coincidence is Nephi Anderson. She tells me that the question he met his entire adult life was, are you the Nephi Anderson who wrote Added Upon? Not, are you Nephi Anderson the novelist, or are you Nephi Anderson who wrote The Castle Builder? The name Nephi Anderson triggered only one association, Added Upon, the novel that Richard Craycroft has called an ambitious failure. This truncated view of Anderson's achievements is what Dr. Craycroft's paper has served to correct. It's unfortunate when a man who wrote 10 novels is remembered for only one, and when that one happens to be his weakest, then we need to be enlightened. But the paradox remains. The literary failure was and is the enduring popular success. As dean of the BYU College of Humanities, Dr. Craycroft weighs Added Upon in the critical balance and finds it wanting, yet he indicates that as a teenager, he was completely under its spell. The flyleaf of the copy of Added Upon I read for this paper bore the handwriting of another teenager written many decades earlier, Huldah Morrell, Byron, Wyoming, 1909. I don't know how many other books my grandmother owned as a single 17-year-old girl, how many others she could have afforded, but she had that one. Dr. Craycroft's overview of these novels and his reevaluation of Anderson are not the kind of paper that call for a challenge or a rebuttal. I, too, have now read the novels of Nephi Anderson, and nothing is more clear than the irony that Dr. Craycroft has outlined. The one novel that brought him popular fame is the one least able to bear the weight of critical scrutiny. For several reasons, Added Upon does not seem to be the kind of a book to catch public fancy. The personages in the opening segment, the pre-earth life, speak a stiff, pseudo-scriptural English as if high-minded pre-earthly conversation most naturally sprang forth in passive voice and inverted word order with a preference for words like thus and henceforth. And as Anderson moved from that segment to others, I had the same feeling I sometimes get when I watch television late at night and doze off. I wake up suddenly and recognize neither the characters nor the setting. Have I slept through the program break or just through an important transition? I can detect no continuity. Suddenly we were in Norway. Suddenly we were in Chicago. Suddenly we were meeting the King of Poland. The changes were abrupt and unjustified. Such problems are not likely to endear a volume to the average reader. So I would like to examine this question for a few minutes this afternoon. Why the popularity? For all his technical failings as an inexperienced novelist, Anderson's instincts led him straight in the direction of the one great function of the popular novel, wish fulfillment. It is a wish fulfillment novel in not one, but two major ways. Over 1,300 years ago, an Anglo-Saxon king named Edwin explained his decision to abandon his pagan ways and convert to Christianity. He said that as a pagan, he thought of human life as a sparrow flying into a brightly lit mead hall from a dark, stormy night into the door at one end, flying through the mead hall and out the door at the other end. That tiny flash of warm brightness between the two unknowns of the earthy blackness, of the murky blackness, were all we knew. The tiny flash was all we knew about earth life. What lies before and after was a mystery. The attraction Christianity held for him, said King Edwin, was that it gave at least some hints to fill in those unknowns. LDS people like to think that Mormonism fills in all the unknowns. The theology is complete, giving an overview of the whole of human existence, pre-earth life and its purpose, post-earth life and its rewards, and the connection between our earthly life and both of these existences. But how much do we really know, especially about pre-earth life? The theology gives us general outlines, but what actually goes on when we are in that state? The plan of salvation deals in millennia, not a day-to-day calendar. Do we talk to other individuals before this life? What about? Who are our associates, and how do we get to be connected with them? What are our worries, our pleasures, our assignments? How are things organized? We want to view those scenes. Perhaps our belief in life before and after this one cannot be quite as strong until, through our imagination or shared folklore, we've begun to fill in some of these details. If there was a life before this, we must somehow apprehend it in a more concrete form than the meager official information allows us. As Dr. Craycroft indicated, this novel, Miltonic in its scope, took shape in Anderson's mind over the space of several years. It must have required considerable courage to be the first to decide, I will go ahead and boldly fill in what the scriptures leave out. The popularity of the novel in these terms is not so hard to understand. King Edwin turned to Christianity because its teachings filled in those unknown spaces. We turn to Addedupon because its narrative does the same for us. It is the incarnation of our hopes. We want fervently to believe that we came to earth with a purpose and a mission, that after this life we will continue among our friends and relatives. And Anderson gives us exactly this, a wish fulfillment novel in the most profound sense. So the first kind of wish fulfillment is theological wish fulfillment, but no less important in the novel's popularity, I feel sure, is the second kind, one familiar to any reader of popular fiction, romantic wish fulfillment. A wise religion professor of mine, Roy Doxey, once said, "Of course, there is absolutely no scriptural basis for the notion that a man and a woman might fall in love in the pre-earth life and commit to marry when they come to earth. But if a married couple is so happy that they believe that's what happened, who would want to disillusion them?" The major audience for Addedupon seems to have been teenagers. I asked a friend of mine, now in her late 70s, why she had loved Addedupon so much when she first read it at the age of 13. Her answer was one simple sentence: "I was thrilled with the idea that we might have known our sweetheart before." The most romantic of all romantic notions. The suspense is not gone, thank goodness, since the young person has not yet met that predestined one true love. Yet the painful uncertainty is taken care of. He is there, or she is there, somewhere, and the moment of meeting is going to be sheer spiritual magic. I can imagine what this meant to my grandmother. And best of all, this novel that made your heart go pity-pat and triggered every kind of romantic daydream was a novel your parents wanted you to read. No need to feel guilty or read on the sly. Anderson's special brand of romance, true love within a framework of spiritual destiny and as a reward for righteous behavior, was faith-promoting and approved. Anyone who condemns Anderson for his insistent preaching to his readers should remember that anything called a novel was suspect at that time among right-thinking LDS people. A work of fiction earned its acceptance only by reinforcing especially those values that might set impressionable young people on the right path. In 1896, just 2 years before Addedupon appeared, George Q. Cannon and Sons published a work by Hannah Sorensen called What Women Should Know. Hannah Sorensen lists 8 causes of promiscuity and too early physical maturation among young women. The 8 causes are luxury, stimulants, indolence, hot rooms, pruriency of thought, novel reading, round dancing, and secret association with the opposite sex. Novel reading without further qualification is listed as an evil. Anderson himself makes some interesting distinctions. When one of his characters reads David Copperfield, that character is doing something praiseworthy. But when Dora, dull Dora, the problematical heroine of John St. John, chooses to read Pride and Prejudice, this is to symbolize her shallow thinking. So if the LDS community was to take a novel to its heart, that novel had to teach and improve them. Anderson sometimes surprises us by departing from what we would consider the formula Mormon romantic novel. For example, in A Girl of the North, the opening pages show our heroine determinedly and joyfully beating her fiancé in the Norwegian National Regatta. She brings her boat in first, he comes in second. I waited within the next couple of chapters for her to come to a womanly realization of what a blunder she had made. To be sweet and humble and promise him she'd never put him in the shadows again. But Anderson doesn't even suggest this. The triumph belongs to her. All admire her for it. The novel closes with another example of her strength and physical courage when she sails out into a storm to rescue the boyfriend and five other men from a sinking steamer. The Norwegian government honors her for her bravery. The story of a bold, attractive heroine whose feats are accepted and admired is refreshing. Many times Anderson depicts Mormon life in a way that is not particularly idealized. The persuasive, dedicated missionary who completely changes the life of Marcus King later becomes so critical of Brigham Young and other authorities that he gives it all up, with Marcus King yelling after him, "You'll never get away from Mormonism." When John St. John joins the saints in Far West, he finds life among the saints quite boring and says so. And in many instances, when alluding to the sermons of even the mightiest of the brethren, Anderson will tell us, with a true English teacher's discernment, that the sermon was not really well put together or even coherent. But if Anderson's best literary impulses came in the later novels, added upon shows his most shrewd and even brilliant insight into human nature. The human race has two overwhelming desires, love and immortality. Anderson gives us both, interweaving the two and dramatizing their fulfillment. It was bold and original. It was also, in part, a stunt. He resisted the temptation to try it again. All his subsequent novels, though literarily of higher quality, are more earthbound, and he can only be admired for realizing that stunts are never as impressive the second time.
Thank you, Karen. We have some time for some questions or comments. We make sure you speak up so that we can...
My State Relief Society president's mother was 30 years old when this book came out. She married at 22. By then she had three or four children. I came to this session to find out why she talked about added upon all her life. I often wonder if she ever read any of the book. And thanks to the Book of Mormon, that was her Bible. Now, my question is, whether the book was good or bad, wouldn't its appeal be to people like her, its ideal Mormon perfection in every way, and therefore attract quite a few readers of that age?
I think Karen may have spoken to that, but I think it may be to that kind of person that it would make an appeal, but certainly the teenagers make an appeal, and it makes an appeal. And after many years, people continue to love it, as she has suggested. I made a slur about this while I was writing the paper to my secretary, who became incensed. She's 30-something years old. I don't dare say. But she's over 30, and she still has a remarkable affection for Added Upon. She hasn't read any of the other books. I had her go back and read it again, and she went back and still loved it. When I went back and read it again, I was amazed that I loved it. I did love it. As a 14-year-old boy, that was very important for unraveling the plan of salvation for me. It put it down. I think Karen probably puts her finger on it. The sense of romanticism and the sense of wish fulfillment is very strong with me. You want to add something to that, Karen? Yes?
I've read a whole lot of paper.
I really can't answer that. I've heard the non-printing, reprinting of Added Upon is the only thing I've heard because of its... they didn't allow him to shape doctrine like they allowed Eliza Snow to shape it. That doctrine of that idea, at least, that we have met our mates before and have pledged eternal fealty before we came here, was really fostered by him and has not become church doctrine. But I've never heard anything, maybe someone else has, about any suppression. I think it would be... The church probably wouldn't like to see it, the story of a missionary reprinted, because the missionaries that he portrays are all older missionaries. They're in their 20s, and And they all are worried about their sweethearts at home, and they do a lot of no-nos that missionaries just and think things that missionaries shouldn't do. And to suggest that any missionary would fall in love with a British saint and that they actually did they kiss? I can't remember. Do they have any?
He kisses her on the forehead if he thinks she's dying.
And then he gets transferred, which is still very modern. But that would certainly not go over with leaders today. I think several of the books would be very readable today if they can do what they've done to the Hardy Boys and modernize them. Maybe someone could modernize Nephi Anderson a little bit, and I think it might have a readership. Yes.
All I know is.
Do you have any of his other works in your bookstore?
Oh, I have maybe six or seven of them.
Of Added Upon or the other? You have the others. As I understood, there was a period where it was not being published as often. I don't know when that was.
Always seems to be woods are full of them.
I think
in
Gene England's Mormon Lit class, he and I team taught. I think we asked the last time around, there were how many in there? 30 maybe, and I think maybe 13, 14 had read Added Upon. I think that's quite typical among Mormon youth today. A big chunk of them have still read it, and they don't respond well to slurs on it. Even though they know as English majors that it's not good writing, still it has a sympathetic response. Yes, Darren?
Regardless of whether its doctrine was accepted later, wasn't that the ideal of every Mrs. True Blue Mormon like my mother in 1900? Those things, those idealistic.
Oh yeah, I think that's the idealism of it is rich, and I think also the idea that your true blue mother may have met and married the man she was cut out to marry in the pre-existence, as they then called it.
I don't think that was the case.
Well, they had to get those genes together to make Theron Luke. Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting. The thing is, there's a study on Nephi Anderson by Grant Anderson, his grandson at BYU, and he insists, as do several others who have written about Anderson, that his real motivation was genealogy, and for him the most important thing was work for the dead, and the base of every one of his works was work for the dead, and you have to get people married and married in the temple so they can do work for the dead, and so let's get that out of the way so we can get on to the important things. Yeah.
Is there a place where you can get some of this stuff and have someone?
His bookstore is right across the street from DI in Provo, north of
Maury.
And I think Sam Weller has some too. Castle Builder seems to have I have a gift edition in soft leather of Castle Builder imprinted with my aunt's name, my late aunt Cicely J. White. And I think there were a lot of gift editions of it, and it was very popular. Yes. I don't really think I'd have claimed that he was the first one with it, but I think he was probably the most popularizer of the doctrine anyway. Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I think there are several factors. I think one of the major factors was the policy, the editorial policy of the church magazines. One example, B.H. Roberts wrote a very interesting novel for the Improvement era, maybe it was earlier, called Corianton, which then was taken by a man named Bean and made into a play called Corianton and Aztec Romance, which ran for a long while at the Salt Lake Theater, and then was redacted and ran on Broadway for 2 years. And they took the Mormonism out and ran it as a Aztec romance, and it was very popular. I guess B.H. Roberts is the only Mormon general authority to have a play on Broadway. My point is that story could not be published in a church magazine today because it is about the Book of Mormon and it is fiction about the Book of Mormon, and the church editorial policy is no fiction about scriptures or scriptural characters. Now, Anderson doesn't fall into that too much, but he would certainly violate the missionary. They you can't have the kind of missionaries around that he had. But I think that for him particularly, I think he probably drifted, particularly in Dorian, to a realism that the church wasn't ready for. And at least if you look at what was printed from 1920s and 1930s, you get a different, very interesting, a different kind of short story than Anderson was heading for.
Maureen?
I think they probably lean more toward the latter than the former. I think that Telia is an exception, but a remarkable exception. She's one of his greatest characters, and really a lot of fun. And she is stronger than her handsome lover, who becomes her husband. Although he makes some important decisions too. But I think mainly, I don't know how you can help on that, Karen. I think the characters are. Oh, there's some strong women. Janet in Marcus King Mormon is a strong woman who insists that he go back and see his former beloved before he marry her. And I don't think you can say he has a bunch of weak women. Dora is terrible, but it's generally the man who has to go through the greatest, although Atelier is a remarkable exception.
Perhaps we should close on the note that if the Correlation Committee hears of this, Nephi Anderson's works may be the next 5 years of priesthood lessons. Thank you very much.